Thursday, May the 6th. We have a couple bills in front of us today dealing with agricultural issues and trespass issues on rural lands. Couple Senate bills. We'll start out. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 674. Harrison, while we're looking at the paperwork, maybe you can give us a little history on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 674 makes federally owned tracts of land containing less than 25,000 acres subject to state laws regulating open range, fencing, stray livestock, and the creation of livestock districts. This may not represent a real change. The current law defines federal lands as lands containing over 25,000 acres, and that those lands are not subject to the law. So this probably clarifies that lands under 25,000 acres are subject.
How, as a question here, how can we deal with federal lands on this issue? How does state law deal with federal lands on an issue like this? Do we know that, or is that a question we need to find out?
Mr. Chair, I did not research that issue specifically.
I think what we need to learn here, and we have Van Stonebrink here, who represents the Oregon cattlemen. We need to have probably a little education on the open range law and how all that works. And with that, welcome, Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The bill you have before you today is more of a clarification. The law presently states, in dealing with open range, and I'll be glad to explain that in just a moment, but it simply says that presently the federal lands that are containing 25,000 acres or more are not subject to the laws of the state, meaning subject to the open range laws, of course. That is a little not too clear, and I'll tell you why it became not too clear in a moment, as to, well, what about if it's less than 25,000 acre block? Do they still have to obey then? Do they obey open range laws, or are they still exempt? And I have before you also a letter from John Hayes, a rancher in Baker County. And this came about because of his situation. And I'll, if I may go to the blackboard, I can explain that.
Beginning of the open range laws.
Are you going to be able to pick you up on a mic there?
Can you still pick me up on this?
Pull the blackboard over, maybe even a little bit more.
My school teaching days, I always work from this side of the board, so I'm sorry. In the beginning of the history of open range, if this is the state, everything is open, meaning what? As far as livestock are concerned, that livestock may roam anywhere they wish, and if you don't want them on your property, it's your job to fence them out. And you build the fence. And so as most of the population came to the western side of the state, then there were counties who began to form districts, and they would say, we wish to have a district in which we will not be in the open range concept. And so then anyone within here would follow what we now think of conventional methods, where you fence your cattle in. But they had to first exempt themselves from the open range law.
Now, is the open range law a state law or a federal law?
It's a state law.
Each state has their own...
Each state would do its own thing.
Its own open range law?
That's correct. So, there are a number of counties, mostly on the west side, and cities, most all throughout the state, which are big farm districts, so that you don't have cattle roaming around in the streets of your city. And if you happen to, in the little town that I grew up in, farm near in Austin, if you had a horse in the city limits, you had to build a fence around to keep the horse there. Okay, so where does the open range law still exist? Primarily in eastern and southern Oregon, this area, which of course is the least populated area of the state. What happens is, and because 52% of the state by the federal government. And you'll see that most of the land is over in this area as well. So that actually makes that particular area much higher in federally owned or federally managed lands. Now, the present law says that if it's 25,000 acres or more, they don't have to obey Oregon law. Primarily, what the reason for this is because of the large areas of federal forest lands. And so within those lands, they're saying we're exempt from this. Now, what happened, and I'm going to enlarge the...
Let me ask you a question here. What do you mean they do not have to obey Oregon open range law? What is the practical effect of that?
Okay, let's take a section here that's out of a federal forest and enlarge it and say that's all federal forest, particular forest, some law, state law, whatever. And suppose that you own a 320 or 640 or 80 acres in that. So you privately own this land within federal lands. And normally, what would happen is that your cattle may roam anywhere they wish because it's open range. And they're saying, no, this is federally owned land and it's more than 25,000 acres, then you must build a fence and keep your cattle in unless you have a permit to graze the rest of out on the forest land. So they say, we're exempt, we don't have it. And so that would be the case where a private landowner was inside a federally owned land. Now, what we have in Baker, or the example I'm going to use in Baker County, there is a rancher there that owns quite a large tract of land, a privately owned land, and within that is an 80-acre parcel that's owned by the U.S. Forest Service. Now, previously, he just got a permit, and he grazed that 80 acres in that particular area, very, very steep area. He gets about 5 AUMs, 5 animal unit months, which isn't very much. But because it's inside, rather than cause a hassle, he's always had a permit, no problem. 2 years ago, we came up with a 401 certification, 401 being the section of the Federal Clean Water Act, that for a little while, ranchers who went to graze on Forest Service land had to get a separate certification from DEQ, the Oregon Department of Agriculture, to then go back to Forest Service to get their permit. And this had all to do with water quality. At the time this was happening, Mr. Hayes, who you have a letter, I have a letter for you, had two other, let's just say they were areas like this, two other parcels that he grazed from the Forest Service. And he did get certification on those two. He got a range manager to help him put the plan together at a cost of about $6,000. So he thought, okay, finally I got my plan, I got it to DEQ, they've approved it, I got my permit. Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service permit. I said, oh, guess what, remember that 80? Yes. You have to have a special certification for that as well. So they got into a little argument about whether he did or didn't, and he said, finally, he said, hey, just take that land. I don't even want to graze it anymore. You can just have that permit. I don't want it. And the Forest Service said, well, then you have to build a fence. You have to build a fence around this, which is very steep, very costly. There's virtually no, very little pasture on that anyway. And he said, no, under Oregon open range law, if you're a private, if this were not, let's for a moment think that this wasn't federal land, this was another private landowner who didn't want you to graze under Oregon's open range law, this landowner would have to build a fence to keep the cattle out. Now, because it was the Forest Service, Federal Forest Service, they said, you have to build a fence. And Mr. Hayes said, no, you, under open range law, you have to build a fence. Forest Service said, well, we're the federal government, and we don't have to obey Oregon's laws. So I go back and I look at Oregon's law, and I find what's before you today is that Oregon's law excludes them if they have a huge holding. But what about if it's a small holding? What if it's a smaller holding? And so what we have is a situation where just because the landowner happens to be the federal government, they have told him verbally that they don't have to obey Oregon's laws. what this bill would do is simply clarify the rest of, you know, what it doesn't say. What about if it's less than 25,000 acres? And we're just simply saying, then they will have to obey or use open range laws.
Well, this is a fence mending bill, or fence building bill here.
As you know, Mr. Chairman, fence building is very expensive, and especially in extremely steep terrain.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Beyer.
Glenn, I'm trying to figure out how this would extend to my own purposes, and I suddenly realize I'm going to have to clear a conflict of interest on this bill, because our ranch, which is inside the federal forest boundary and butts up against the Forest Service on two sides completely, but on another side there is a section, 640 acres of Forest Service that is surrounded by private land. Currently we have to fence our cows out of that land. I think this bill would change that. Is that true?
If I understand you correctly, this little, instead of 80, would be a 640.
640.
And it would be federal owned land inside of privately held lands, and that would be correct.
Well, we have federally owned small section within large section of private, and then we have large sections of federal with small sections of private within. So we have reverse situations here.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And in the first situation that I talked about, if you were a private landowner inside of federally owned lands, you didn't want to have a grazing permit that would just let them roam everywhere. It would be the private landowner's obligation to build a fence to keep their cattle in, which is contrary to open range law. But that is because of the way the Oregon law is structured. It exempts them from 25,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this sounds really great, but the applicability of Oregon imposing Oregon's range law on federal lands, I think, runs into the problem where we may be sending the wrong message out to Oregon landowners, because by through the suggestion that, well, you're going to be protected under Oregon law, under Oregon's open range law, and so therefore you won't need to go get these permits, and just sort of my limited knowledge of construction of federal laws is you're still going to be hauled into federal court, and they're going to look at you and go, you know, you're still liable for not having these permits in federal land.
Chairman Wells, Representative Hill, I understand your concern. What happens, however, right now is that we have a status out there where very seldom is that situation happening. It's only when the situation like Mr. Hayes' situation, and they're saying, if you no longer want to, they're virtually holding a hammer over his head, saying you must get you must graze our land. Because if you don't, we're going to make you build a fence. And if you don't build a fence, we will get you for trespass. In fact, under Oregon law, open range law, they would use open range law to get him for trespassing.
Representative Hill, yes, go ahead.
They may not be able to prosecute under Oregon law with this, but this is not going to remove the responsibility that if they don't build a fence and their cows go and graze on federal land, that they would then be in violation of federal if they don't get the appropriate permits. That's my point, is that the federal government wouldn't be able to prosecute somebody under Oregon's laws, but in terms of, so the message I think we need to be very careful is that we can remove the trespass issue under state law, but, you know, if you need a permit to graze federal lands, you still need a permit to graze federal lands from the federal government. This, by doing this, doesn't change that.
Chairman Wells, Representative Hill, I agree with you. What happens in most cases between, let's suppose we had two private landowners with a common boundary. What happens is that we go out and the you go to the middle of your fence and you build everything to the right, and the other person goes to the middle of the fence from his standpoint and he builds everything to his right. And that works very well. The only time that we have a problem is a situation like this. And I'm sure in Representative Byer's case is that he may, if this law were to pass, he may say, now, how about it, federal government? You build your half and I'll build my half, or I'll maintain my half. I understand that it's already built. What we begin to come down to, and I didn't know if we want to go there or not, is a state's rights issue. And this may actually perpetuate it to a point to say, who really owns the lands of the state? And we could probably have a two-day debate on this, but I did do some research on the making of the Oregon Constitution, which really meant the making of statehood. And there is nowhere from the making of this state back through the making of the U.S. Constitution and before which says anything about the federal government retaining these large tracts of land. And in fact, the state of Oregon, the territorial legislature, signed an agreement in statehood, one of the propositions required by the federal government before they would grant statehood, that they would dispose of the soils of the state. And they understood this from the reading of the transcript of the territorial government of Oregon prior to statehood, that these lands would be privately held lands, which would create wealth for the state. And what has happened is that the federal government did dispose up to a point and have stopped disposal of those lands. In fact, it is in the process of trying to acquire more, and that's another story.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Obermacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, there's a well-established law going back to our beginning that a state cannot preempt federal law. We cannot tell the federal people what to do on their own property. This is federal property, and we can argue what it was supposed to be and so forth, but it is federal property for us to enact a law that says, you know, they have to follow our law, really has little import. And in fact, as whoever drafted Senate Bill 674 recognized it, it says to the extent permitted by federal law, they're acknowledging the federal law has priority and we can't affect that. So unless the federal law have passed a law waiving their sovereignty, so to speak, over the federal land, a particular federal land, this really is not going to do anything. And I think, as Representative Hill said, it may leave a false impression in some of the cattlemen's mind, and they would go forward with certain activity and end up being in federal court. I think we're giving them a false expectation.
That was one of the first questions I asked Glenn, was whether we could tell the federal government in this case. I have a question going back to the testimony here of Mr. Hayes. Evidently, he spent $6,000 to get a 401 certification on some of his land. But evidently, it would be quite a process to go ahead and do that for this 80 acres.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. He would virtually have to go through the same amount of paperwork, even though it was a small parcel, whether it's a small parcel or a large parcel. He would have to go through the same amount of paperwork to satisfy the requirements, the rules, if you will, under the 401 concerns with the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And that's when he just said, it just isn't worth it.
Seems like then Senate Bill 1010 is the one that's causing more of the problem here than anything else, having to abide by that law there.
Mr. Chairman, it, at that point in time, it came about because of a federal court case. And there was a court case brought before Federal Judge Haggerty under Section 401 that said that if cattle are grazing, that they may be considered to be a point source pollution. And that federal judge says, yes, I agree with you, because they may cause a water quality problem. since that time, that his decision has been overruled by the Ninth Circuit Court, and in fact, just recently, after it was asked to go back to the Ninth Circuit Court, they agreed that no, they would not hold it, the decision would stand, that they've disagreed with that judge and said no, cattle are grazing on land, federal lands are not a point source, in fact a non-point source, and therefore are not not brought under the requirements of 401. If I could, Mr. Chairman, could I address your question on telling the federal government? It's quite an interesting thing because we have the supremacy clause of the U.S. Constitution, which says that those laws under the federal Constitution are supreme, and we understand that. But by the same token, they have to, first of all, be constitutionally correct, which is somewhat questionable, but you end up going to the Supreme Court, which is very expensive to do that. Secondly, there are laws within counties. If you think about it for a moment, there's a lot of federal land, and there are county roads that go out there, and there are speed limits, and there are criminal things that you can't do on federal lands because the county law or a state law would prohibit you. So you can't, federal government can't just do anything they wish to just because they say it is our lands or it's being managed by the federal government. This would be one that would be a situation where we would be somewhat challenging the federal government. But by the same token, I'm wondering, why do we have it in Oregon statute that exempts them? If prior legislature decided that it be necessary to exempt them when it's large tracts, why didn't they just simply say on all federal lands? Why did they just do it on the large tracts? And the only history I can find of this is because it is things like federal forest lands, huge areas that they're concerned with.
So Glenn, if we pass this the governor signs it, what would be the next step? What's going to happen in practicality is, you as the Cattlemen Association or whatever going to be able to have a stronger hand in dealing with the U.S. Forest Service and BLM?
Mr. Chairman, what we believe would happen is that, let's use the John Hayes case for a moment because it's very relevant, is that he could go to them and say, you know what, this just passed the Oregon legislature, and rather than getting into a huge argument, either, you know, you build half, I'll build half, like any two private landowners would, because that's what you're really dealing with here. Or, you know, if you really had to test it, he could say, well, you have to build it. If you don't want my cattle there, you have to build it. And then there would be a test case. And I can't speak for him. I wish he were here, but he probably would test this, in fact, if he was pushed. Then let the federal law, which I have not been able to find one, that says that they will not obey. There is a court case that deals with open range, but it, again, is on one of those greater than 25,000 acres, and they cite Oregon law. So somewhere the federal government is recognizing Oregon law on one hand when it works for them. What would they do if this were to pass? And there would probably have to be a test case to see what would happen. And we would like to, at least it would clear it up so that we would know whether they have to obey this or not.
President Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I didn't go back to the statute book and look, but in the small summary of the bill, it says lands less than 25,000 acres. Is that contiguous, or is it because, as in my own personal case, where our property is inside the federal forest boundary, thank you, yet this one small tract is not contiguous to the rest of the federal forest, which is much larger than 25,000 acres?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I would only have to assume that would be the intent of that law, since it doesn't say, when it says tracks. I believe it says tracks. No,
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. It does not use the word contiguous, but it does use the word the phrase tract of land.
Well, it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that would that entire federal forest then be considered a tract of land, and the 640 acres that is not contiguous to the rest of it, but our property is actually in between the two, would that be part of that tract of land? it seems like we'd have to have some kind of language.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I'm going to go with the premise that 640 would not be the same track as the large track over here.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have large tracks everywhere throughout the state, and some of them could be separated by a few hundred yards, some of them could be separated by 100 miles. And I think that the continuity would be the question. If it's separated at all, it's not part of the same track.
Representative Hill.
Does the federal government have open range laws on federal lands?
Chairman Wells, Representative Hill, they do not. And again, going back to the only court case that that I have studied on this that I've been able to find, it was a case where, in fact, the federal government was trying to claim open range law. I believe it was on the Siuslaw National Forest when they allowed one of their burros to roam free and was hit by a car. And then they said, well, this is open range in this federal forest. The judge, at least in this case, said, no, you can't fall under that. Now, had it been out in the private lands of open range under the laws of the state, it would have been open range. And so the judge, in fact, said, you're exempt. You're exempt from Oregon laws.
That is an interesting question. I never thought about the really open range doesn't extend to public lands. Oh, private land, open range is on.
That's correct, Chairman.
So did the judge then rely on Oregon law saying that it wasn't? Or what was, do you know what it was?
Representative Hill, I'm trying to recall it, and perhaps I should have, I can pick it up and study that question if it's relevant, and it may be. I can't recall it exactly, and I've read a few more cases since then.
Are you an attorney?
No, sir. I don't know whether that's an advantage or disadvantage. I have been told by attorneys that you have to go back and check case law, and so that's what I was doing.
Representative Ubala says she has to leave here because she needs to testify, but she's our resident
counsel here, attorney. She feels that what the state would have to defend this bill if we passed it?
If we passed it because it's state law, we would have to, if anybody challenged it, we'd have to defend it.
Chairman Wells, Representative Ubala, I would sincerely hope that would be the case, because our deep feeling is that we have been run roughshod over by the federal government, continue to be so, and in all earnest, I really believe, maybe this is just personally speaking, I shouldn't speak for the cabinet, but I think I do on this, is that it is time that the state government did stand up and say, where are our state's rights?
That you chased her out.
Representative Ubala has some concerns about that from that viewpoint, that I believe she feels that our standing wouldn't be that good, and has some concerns of moving the bill from that basis. It would be a little bit of an uphill battle, but I guess that's a decision we have to make as a committee, whether we want to go ahead and move this out, let the chips fall where they may. Let's talk about that. If you as an organization or individual cattleman over there push this through, then how involved would our attorney general have to get into this issue?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how involved they would have to. If it came down to where the federal government took action, let's say, against Mr. Hayes then could file a case against the federal government from imposing something that was under state law he didn't have to do. That would probably be the point, the trigger, where the state could choose to help him and join him or not.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Perhaps we could ask Legislative Council, we've got the second bill, ask Legislative Council to come down. And
I don't mind in terms of going forward in sort of testing the state's rights issues, but if the, you know, it's loaded against us because the feds have some, you know, law that's already that says this isn't work, you know, my only concern is that we send the wrong message to ranchers and we get them into a bigger pickle than if we were just to do nothing. And I appreciate, you know, where Mr. Hayes is in this issue, you know, sort of the weighing the cost of building the fence versus getting the permit, you know, and
Chairman Wells, Representative Hill, I appreciate that on behalf of the cattlemen. I think we're at a point, because presently we're involved with 5 lawsuits, all of them designed to reduce or eliminate grazing on federal lands. And I think we would certainly hope at some point that we can get some assistance from our state, because it always falls upon the same pockets. And I'll tell you the truth, that because of markets and other things, those pockets are just about turned inside out at the present time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Well, it seems to me like the, you know, and I understand Representative Hill's concern about sending the wrong message, but as far as defending the state being forced to defend this, you know, the first line of the bill says to the extent permitted by federal law. So, obviously, I think if, you know, this Legislative Council ever drafted this, instantly put in the caveat that we're not going to have to defend it, because if the feds say it's federal law, then the state's going to say, well, it says right in the law to the extent permitted by federal law. So I don't see the state being in the position of defending this law when you put that caveat in the first line of it.
There was any problem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would kind of follow up on what Representative Beyer was saying there. I would think that the only way the state would end up the AG would end up defending this as if the feds actually filed suit against the state with regards to this. I think that the cattlemen, sorry to say this, but I think they would still probably be in the situation where they would be fighting out in court what the state law allows and what the feds allow, and that still would probably end up being their nickel. I would think that the AG probably wouldn't be involved unless the feds specifically filed a suit against the state based on this law.
Representative Hill.
I agree with Representative Beyer. The way that this is written, you're not going to get your test case out of this, because the AG wouldn't go defend it, because it's limited to whatever the interpretation of federal law is. And,
Chairman Wells, Representative Hill, again, I think the only question that could be there would be if the federal government said they had authority, such as the ranger did here, and forced him to do something, or attempted to force him to do something, and yet it was a little unclear as to whether federal law really had that authority to do that or not. And it would only be if it was unclear. And this happens continually, so the burden continues to fall upon our individual ranchers to go back and try to figure out or fight the federal government whether that law is clear or not. So they usually shrug their shoulders and say, okay.
I think you're still going to be in that boat, because the Attorney General would make a determination as to the validity of the federal government's claim, and if they say, yeah, it's valid, they're not going to go defend it. Versus if you take out that first 5 words there, and, then that would force the Attorney General to have to defend the law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beyer.
I think Representative Hill is exactly right. I think that, at least on that part, I do think that the cattlemen could get their test case, but I also think at the same time they'd be paying for their own test.
That's the point. Yeah.
Well, as Harrison pointed out, the Attorney General really represents state agencies, not private citizens. And so, how would they get involved? How would the Attorney General get involved in a case that's a private suit?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that would become a case that if state law is contradicting federal law, then the Attorney General would be involved. But in this case, it clearly says, to the extent permitted by federal law. So the Attorney General would just say, too bad, you know, fight it out, man. I'm not an attorney, but that's why.
Yeah, I think the function is to basically do a writ of mandis, or is it?
Yeah.
To enforce the law.
Well, if I have the votes, I'm in mind to move this thing out and let it fly by its own wings and whatever, and at least let them fight it out. So with that, close the hearing, go into a work session on Senate Bill 674.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee.
And
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 674 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think if we can count the five, President Hodgson has.
Yeah, this is a big.
I guess then, Samantha, call the roll, please.
Before, Mr. Chair, I do have to state a potential conflict of interest as I own a property that probably would be affected by this law.
Chair
Wells?
Yes.
Thompson? Everybody's not here as excuse.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes, but I reserve the right to vote against them before I need more information.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Receive the majority votes. Senate Bill 674. Moved to the floor. Anyone interested in carrying this little jewel?
Sure, I'll carry my conflict of interest bill, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Byer would carry. We'll have a closed work session on 674. Now we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 670. Harrison, what do we know about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 670 mandates the revocation of certain recreational licenses, tags, permits. Those are generally hunting and fishing. Tags, permits, and licenses. Also, certificates of number issued for boats. Upon conviction of several general criminal prohibitions, they include criminal trespass, criminal mischief, unlawful discharging of a weapon in several circumstances over airports, over highways. If one of these licenses, tags, or permits is mandatorily revoked, a person is prohibited from obtaining another one for at least 2 years. In the case of hunting and fishing licenses and tags, there's a graduated suspension. That is, after the second revocation, you'd lose your opportunity for 3 years. After the third, you'd lose your opportunity for 5 years.
Say that again now.
Yeah, I know that was. What this does is, if a person is violated of criminal trespass, criminal mischief, or unlawfully discharging a weapon, that person's hunting and fishing licenses would be revoked, mandatorily revoked.
I thought it was for 24 months.
For the first violation, you would lose it for 24 months. For a second violation, you would lose your hunting and fishing licenses for 3 years. For a third or subsequent, you would lose your opportunity to hunt and fish for 5 years. In the case of certificates of number, which identify boats, you would only lose it for 2 years.
Representative Hill?
On certificates, is there a requirement that if you own a boat that it must have it? So are we putting people in? There's no requirement. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, there is a certificate of title indicating ownership of large boats, but the certificate of number is required, as I understand it, to put the boat in the water.
And like, only certain size
boats. It's like the license, sort of like the, okay. Yeah, say OR and then,
yeah.
And then the number, that's the...
Well, we have, the number, yeah. We have the Marine Board people here and talk about that, but there's certain size boats that have to have a license or a permit. That, you'll find that language on the back of the bill, the board, talking about the Marine Board there. It should automatically cancel certificate of number, that's on page 4. There, and then also there's another spot in here down on page 2 that says for 2 years.
Mr. Chair, members, I should also probably mention that under current law, the court may revoke for most of these same violations of law with respect to hunting and fishing licenses. This is new law as to the Marine Board.
You know, the language here on the front here, the court shall, that's on line 14. The court shall order is, there will be a little controversy. There are some people who'd like to change that to may. Representative Hill.
What is the relationship of throwing objects at trains and hunting, fishing, and I'm just trying to get the relationship between...
These statute numbers, what, 164, 245, 255, 265, 345, all the way through there are all certain statutes that they've included in this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, throwing objects at train is part of the statute relating to discharging weapons at trains or throwing objects.
So, actually, what we have here, before we call up people to testify, this is a landowner's bill kind of aimed at the issue of people floating down the rivers, floating and then getting trespass on the property and doing these three violations of the law. And then it basically is only upon conviction that these things can happen. And this is part of the floatage issue that has been around the legislature for a couple sessions, not only from the viewpoint of from the people who want to float and have the ability to float and get out on the shore up to the average high watermark and that sort of thing. This issue is one, but from the landowner's viewpoint, they feel people who float down the rivers and that gains an access onto their property to come on and do certain things. And move out away from the river. And the river becomes, in a sense, a road or an access to your property. In my case, that's the way it is. I'm on the Sandy Am. It's a mile from my house. And I hear shooting down there. They've come onto my property by floating down the river, getting out of their boats, and then hunting and picking mushrooms on my property and walking around. And so, they haven't come out on any road or anything, but they've used the river as an access.
Mr. Chair,
this is the issue here.
That may be true, but in fact, in that case, boats that float down the river without use of propulsion don't need to have numbers on them. So this, if this is the attempt to solve that problem, you don't get there.
Well, that's true if they're not on here. So with that, I think we'll call up, let's see, who do we have here to testify on this? We'll have a list here. Paul, why don't you come on up first? And talk about it, how the bill affects your agency and how you see this issue where it revokes specific number on the boat, that sort of thing.
By the way, members, you do have some written testimony that's been submitted on this bill. One is by the requester, Kilpatrick, who talks about some of the issues of land where people come on looking for shed, antelope, deer and elk horns and that sort of thing. And cut fences.
This is Kilpatrick's from Mount Vernon?
Yes.
Okay, right. Okay, welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Heffner, Director of the Marine Board. This bill, as you've noted, directs the Marine Board to cancel boat certificate of number if the person's convicted of various offenses, including first and second degree criminal trespass with a firearm, first, second, third degree criminal mischief, discharge of a firearm across the public road, beach, airport surface or at a train. The Marine Board is prepared to comply with the provisions of Senate Bill 670 if the legislature chooses to pass the measure. However, we do have two or three questions or concerns regarding the mechanics of this of the bill. But first and foremost, and I think you touched on a little bit in your previous discussion here, is that it appears that any conviction for the offenses that are named would result in the cancellation of the boat registration. It doesn't matter if the offense was related to the use of a boat. So if someone were convicted of criminal mischief in a city, had nothing to do with the use of the boat, it would subject them to cancellation of the certificate number. We just want to be sure that that's what the legislature really intends with
that's
this.
That's a good point.
That there is not necessarily a relationship between the offense.
That's the problem we have in writing law, where we get kind of blinders on and we're headed in one direction because we want to affect one particular issue. In this case, it was kind of a trespass issue of people floating down the river. So then we write that law and it brings in a lot wider scope of people we really think about.
The offenses listed are a very broad category of offenses, and I could foresee where that there could be convictions in a number of settings where it had nothing to do with the use of a boat. And as was mentioned, certificates of number are issued for all motorboats and sailboats over 12 feet. So if the issue is river use trespass, it probably in most instances would not get at those particular offenders, since the boats are not required to have a certificate of number if they're river boats. The second concern we have relates to the question of how the court's going to determine that a person has a boat registration to cancel, especially if the offense was not related to the use of the boat. Again, if a person's convicted of one of these offenses off the river or away from a waterway, and it's not in conjunction with a boat, it's not clear to us how the court is going to ascertain that person has a certificate of number which they're going to be ordered to revoke. And I think that's just a practical question.
Would the court need to know that necessarily?
If the court is going to direct us to cancel it,
there has to be an order from the court specifying that. It wouldn't happen just automatically somewhere, be picked up upon convictions of these, that you would then receive that notice.
I believe in Section 3 of the bill on page 2, in subsection 2 of that, it indicates that the court shall send a copy of the order to our board. So, unless they're going to send us an order for...
Oh, it does say that, doesn't it?
Unless they're going to send us an order for everyone that's convicted of any of those offenses. If they're going to do that, there was testimony in the Senate that indicates that, and we don't have convictions, but there were 49,000 vandalism complaints, 5,000 arrests. We don't have information to estimate the impact of this bill in terms of workload in that, but potentially if the court's going to send us every notice of conviction with an order that if the person happens to have a certificate of number, we're going to be chasing a fair amount of paperwork down with those kind of referrals. We would hope that the court would have some way to ascertain that person has a certificate, so they're not deluging us every case of criminal mischief. And finally, just as one other practical consideration, the bill does relate to cancellation of the certificate of number, but it doesn't relate to the certificate of title. And human nature being as it is, we suspect that people that are convicted of these types of offenses where the court would order them to have their boat registration suspended are the same kind of people that will transfer the title to a spouse, next of kin, family member, friend, and then have that person re-register the boat so they really don't have a loss of use privileges. And that's just one of those. If people can figure out a way to get around it, they quickly will.
I guess that's... This is a very good point. I'm just thinking here in terms of how we issue hunting licenses, tags, and permits. You go down to G.I. Joe's and you buy it, and how are they going to know that someone is prohibited? So the person has it, and then he's out. A Fish and Wildlife officer stops him. Show me your tag. Yet, unless that officer knows, or provide them with a booklet of, people, there it's been revoked.
I guess in terms of if they then violate something else, I guess you'll find that, oh, you had an invalid license, because, I mean, but we don't centrally check everyone and register everyone to know.
Yeah, we have George Buckner here from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We'll have him come up here. In fact, you might as well come on up, George, now, and you stay there, Paul, and we'll keep working our way through this. kind of we're on this issue of revocation here, and
With those three concerns, Mr. Chairman, that pretty much concludes my testimony. As I said, we're prepared to implement it if the legislature chooses to pass it, but those are some practical concerns.
Why don't you just stay there, Paul, since more questions come up here.
Chair.
Welcome. Representative Barnes.
Could I ask the committee administrator, it says here fiscal statement issue, but I don't have it in my pack. It isn't actually a fiscal statement.
We do, and I'm sorry that we did not provide that, or if we did not provide that. What it says is the effect on revenues is none. The bill has no anticipated fiscal effects on local governments or districts. Impact is indeterminate. Fish and Wildlife and Marine Board have indicated they are unable to accurately predict the number of tags, license, permits, certificates that would be revoked. So it doesn't add a lot. But I'm sorry that we did not get that to you.
Welcome, George. Buckner.
Chair Wells, members of the committee, my name is George Buckner. I'm Wildlife Division Assistant Director, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I've passed out a statement. I'll just make a few brief comments to sum that up. First of all, we have some of the same concerns as the Marine Board in that hunters and anglers would lose permits for offenses not related to hunting and fishing. This bill would also greatly expand the number of fishing and hunting permits that would be revoked each year. And our department's concerned about the increased workload to the agency, the potential for conflicts between permit buyers and licensed vendors should these vendors be faced with someone who has been blackballed, so to speak, from the system. Additionally, it appears that the bill is inconsistent in that non-license holders who have violated these statutes would be able to purchase a permit. And that basically concludes any comments I have. Anything else we have?
Can you say that last statement again? Expand on that, please.
Well, it appears to us that if someone violates one of these statutes and has their license revoked, that's one thing. But if they violate one of these statutes and they don't own a permit and have never purchased one, I don't see any mechanism in here that would prevent them from going in and purchasing the permit. What in the system would ever notify us if they're not a license holder in the first place?
Currently, do we have a problem of revocation as far as people not being able to buy hunting? Is there any other statutes that keeps you from buying a hunting or fishing license? We have felons that can't carry guns.
Right,
you know,
but those
can't own a gun once you're a convicted felon for life. But where else are we involved in that?
Chair Wells, as pointed out earlier, the court may revoke licenses now for these offenses, and occasionally the court does. And I think we have a list that may have about 40 names on it now of people's licenses who have been revoked. And those are not sent to the license agents. We maintain that list. And what we've done, we've adopted a policy of not putting our license vendors into the position of a potential conflict with a license buyer. We don't blackball anybody out of the system. What we do is we maintain a list. If they do buy a license, then we get notified, and we send an OSP agent out then to revoke that permit. Now, under this bill, I'm not so sure we would be able to continue to do that because the list would become considerably longer than maybe 40 names, and we would have to look at our policy and possibly go into the system then and try to eliminate names so that people could not buy a permit. Then we place our vendors into the potential for conflicts with permit buyers.
Well, Mr. Buckner, do we have the same issue there on the front page of any of these type of convictions, of any of these violations, whether related to being out on the land or whatever, it would all fall under your category of same as the boat issue that he brought up, that any conviction for a criminal trespass would go in, have to go to your records to be for revocation.
I'm not so sure I can answer that, Representative.
Seems to me like it'd be the same issue as Paul brought up. Into the system, and then would go a conviction for any of these issues, whether they were out involved with trespass or that sort of thing, is what the bill is getting at.
Mr. Chair, I think you're exactly right. In fact, the deleted language below lines 23 through 26 of the bill, you know, clearly say there as well, the person was angling, hunting, or trapping.
That's right.
And to me, that, from my own personal interest, I think that makes sense. But to open this up to anyone, whoever has committed violation of criminal trespass and criminal mischief, whether it has anything to do with hunting, fishing, or trapping or not, it's just, this isn't just an open door. This is a Grand Canyon.
I agree.
Chair?
How does that feel?
Let me add to some other... No, just so I understand. So if I own a sailboat, and it's parked out on the Willamette, and I live in it, what's the effect of removing the certificate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, without the certificate, you couldn't operate.
So that it could sit in the marina? I'm just curious in terms of...
It could probably sit there as long as you didn't operate it.
Move it.
As soon as you move it, you'd be subject to a Class B boating infraction.
Could you pull that mic a little?
You'd be subject to a Class B boating infraction for operating without a certificate of number.
Houseboats, the same thing?
No, floating homes are a different category. Floating homes are titled one time. But I think the biggest thing is that many of the potential craft that are involved if this is indeed aimed at river use, most of those don't have a certificate of number to begin with.
I guess what surprises me is how this bill gets out of the Senate with some of these problems. Didn't they talk about any of these issues over there?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, we raised the same testimony in the Senate, and in fact, the bill in the Senate, as I recall, was aimed at horn collecting as opposed to river use. But at least that's the testimony in the Senate, was that there are ranchers in eastern Oregon that have shed antlers on their property. They're worth quite a bit of money, and that this was aimed at people that trespass in order to gather those horns, and in the process cut fences. I tie it in
is because it brought in the issue of the boat and the boat certification. So it brought in a floatage issue, people who run down the river. They're trying to get it both. So I looked at it from that viewpoint, and of course they're along the John Day River over there, and that's a big issue over there. So that's the way I tied the two together in my own mind. Otherwise, why bring in the boat issue?
There was no testimony to that effect in the Senate.
Representative Hill.
I guess sort of the relationship with the related clause, and relating to recreational privileges, but it's, you know, I mean, in terms of it's adding additional punishments, and I understand in terms of how we deal with shoplifting stuff, that's criminal mischief. So, I mean, you get every 15-year-old kid that goes out and shoplifts, you know, if an additional penalty has nothing to do with, you know, I guess you can construe the recreational privileges, but I think in terms of bringing back the language where it's related back to angling, hunting, and trapping, to me, would actually then put it within the purview of the relating clause. The way it's written today, I think it would violate the relating clause.
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Hey, Mark.
I guess I'd like to point out that if we're in... If the intent of the bill is to go after horn collectors, then why, in the language it was taken out, where it says person convicted of, you know, violations while angling, having, trapping, or horn collecting, why don't you add words there rather than open this door for every violation? It doesn't seem to make sense. This bill is much broader than it originally appears.
Unless we're missing something here because the way it's you know, tied into this whole section of revocation of license and tags and permits up in the first subsection talks about that. I don't know how this would relate, whether it opens that door wide open. But it says any person is convicted of a violation,
and then lists that what it says.
The court should order revoke license tag. So it seems to me like that opens the whole door there, whether it's, you know, to your issue as well as to Paul's. Representative, we have 10 o'clock sessions. So we're going to do some of this thing for 10. We're doing fine. Representative Hobson, and we'll have Al Elkins come up, and we have some. We have the steelheaders. So we'll get everybody up here in just a little bit.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chair, till they finish.
Okay. Al, why don't you come on up? And Larry Beaver, yeah, maybe step back just for a minute. Paul, stay up close here. We'll...
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. We share the same concerns that the committee has voiced earlier. The testimony on the Senate side was by Senator Farioli, and he did talk about a rancher who had cervids, deer, and people were coming on his property to pull the horns, dropped horns, and it was a horn gathering situation that prompted this bill. That was the testimony that
Was that extended the testimony over there?
Yes, sir. I testified. I think Mr. Harder testified, and Paul testified, and ODFW testified, and we brought some of the concerns up that were brought up today by the committee and by Paul and by George. There are a number of questions we have. The Representative Beyer brought up the one that I pointed out on lines 27 and 28 of the first page, committed while hunting. This seems to not be in conjunction with lines 13 through 17 of the bill. And we also are concerned about the pressure that it puts on point-of-sale agents, as brought up by Mr. Buckner, and what that does to them. We find the point-of-sale program to be one that's beneficial to us. We wouldn't want to do anything to jeopardize that. And our third concern and last concern was the additional workload that it would have on ODFW, which is, as staff has said, is undetermined at this time. And with the budget constrictions that they are, we are concerned about that as well.
Harrison, we looked yesterday. I've looked at this bill a lot. Worked with Phil Donovan and Harrison worked on it yesterday. You went down to Legislative Council and looked at lines 27 and 28. Seems like there is a conflict between there, the May, and up there, the new language in 13 and 14, because it's addressing the same laws. And up there, it's shall, and down below, it's may. We have a conflict there in those two. And what did they tell you down in Legislative Council, Harrison?
Mr. Chair, I will certainly not be, I will be a poor conduit of Legislative Council's perspective, but it was my understanding that they did not change this section because the two ORSs listed refer back to this provision. They say in both cases that this penalty is in addition to and not in lieu of other penalties for these violations, and so they didn't delete it here because they would have had to amend those other two or sections.
Yeah, we worked on
that. Doesn't sound like anything that you...
We worked on that some yesterday. Harrison caught me on the floor, and we tried to do some work on that, but I don't know that we really have a clear idea exactly how those two sections do fit together, but it seems like that it's not too straight.
Mr. Chair, I'm a loss. Where's the May you're speaking of?
Representative, line 27 and 28.
Mr. Chair, if I could, Representative Beyer, subsection 1, which is the current language, says the court may revoke on the basis of things in subsection 3.
Okay. I see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yeah. It's referring.
And all but one of the statute sections that's now in the mandatory revocation existed in sub 3, and now two of them still do.
The word "may" isn't there.
Good.
All
right.
That concludes any comments I have.
Sure. Welcome, Larry. It's nice to have you here today.
Thank you, Chairman Wells and members of the committee. My name is Larry Beaver. I'm the Director of River Access for the Association Northwest Steelheaders. It's an organization of about 2,000 members with about 20 chapters throughout the state of Oregon. I'd like to speak in regards to this bill, just some general comments. First of all, we, the steelheaders, and I also work with a coalition of river users dealing with river access issues, and we're very concerned about trespass from two points of views. One, yes, there's very serious issues of trespass that must be addressed, and there's less serious issues. And I feel that this bill is a one-size-fits-all, and I'm very concerned about that. For example, when we talk about a river being an access point, well, a river is a highway. If you look at the Admissions Act, it says that all navigable waters of the state shall be common highways. That's exactly what they are. And what is a navigable waterway? A navigable river is a river that has boat traffic on it. The Chetco River was defined as being navigable based upon the historic use of the Indian shovel-nosed canoe by the Chetco Indians and the contemporary use of drift boats. If you see canoes and drift boats coming down a river, it's owned by the state. Okay, so we have two things here. One, we have to deal with the bill itself and the poor wording and the fact that one size fits all, and then we have to deal with the ownership issue. Who really owns, for example, the beds and banks of a waterway? Now, not all trespass cases are the same. Some are deliberate, malicious, and others are not. And a lot of people are going to trespass more or less innocently with no malicious intent, but yet one size fits all. I trespass without any malicious intent. I have three boats that are registered. That's dumb, I know. Everything from a 13-foot canoe that has a motor on it so that the grandkids can have something to fish with when we go up the lakes. And also I have a 14-foot boat that I take on the lakes, and then I have a larger boat for the river and for the bays. And I'm going to lose use of those three boats, and I'm also going to lose my fishing license. If you look at a trespass case in the court, the judge, at least in the one case that I'm very familiar with on the John Deere River, this gentleman is accused of trespass, and he goes to the judge. The judge says, okay, you have two choices here. We have three choices. One of them, actually, the first choice is you can plead guilty and take your fine, or you can plead guilty with an explanation and take your fine, or you can come back with your attorney at a later date. So if a person is going to say, look, Your Honor, I did go above the high water mark of the river, or yes, I was on the bank of that river, and but I feel that it was not, you know, you have some sort of an explanation. Did make a difference. This bill is written so that, by golly, I'm going to lose, that person is going to lose his boat permits, he's going to lose his fishing license.
If he's convicted.
Yes, sir. Yes, if he's convicted. And I'm sure that most judges are going to be fair, but when you look at a law such as this, if you take it absolutely literally and look at it from that point of view, it can be used totally literally. If an officer is looking for a reason to bust somebody, they certainly can use this law to do that. And if a judge wants to be, you know, absolutely set in his mind that this person is guilty, he can, you know, that's what's going to happen. You're going to be guilty. So this is a very emotional issue. I was doing an interview with Grant Nakomi on the Sandy River, and the guide that set it up said, Larry, this property owner we're going to launch from does not like fishermen, so I would suggest that if he shows up there, you kind of keep a low profile. Well, we did the interview, and afterwards we came back, and the dogs were there, and so obviously the guy was there, and we had to put the boat back on the trailer and come back up through his property. So I took off my badge and my hat and kept a low profile. This guy is suddenly saying to Grant Nakomi and to the photographer and to the guide, and I'm keeping the distance. He says,
any of those blankety-blank fishermen show up on my bank, they're going to get a load of, what's the word? Somebody says rock salt. Yeah, that's it, rock salt. That's pretty serious. Somebody points a gun at somebody, and somebody's going to point a gun back somewhere along the line. So the question is who owns, for example, the property? Who really owns the beds and banks of a river?
This is not that.
I know it's not, but it is a trespass. You see, if I'm going to be arrested, like the man on John Day was arrested for being on the banks below the high water mark of a navigable, quote, river. It's not on the list of 10 navigable rivers in the state, but it's still a navigable river by federal standard.
We're fighting that issue another time.
So here we are. We're dealing with a trespass case that addresses the Sandy River, the Sandium River, all these other rivers, the John Day, all these rivers that have not been affirmed as being definitely owned by the state. There's lots of problems with this law. The wording has to be drastically changed. You've already heard other comments that we agree with that are really wrong with it, and so we would ask that you would disapprove this bill or certainly make changes to it. You're talking about ownership. There's a United States Supreme Court decision that affected Oregon in 1977, and it said that and this is kind of interesting as applied to what was said earlier. The United States Supreme Court said that the shores of navigable waters and the soils under them were not granted by the Constitution to the United States, but were reserved for the states respectively. The prior bill addressed this kind of issue. Here is where the Constitution absolutely ties the ownership of property to the state.
Yeah.
Any questions?
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
If we're going to get into navigability and that whole can of worms, we really would be here a long time. And I agree. It's a good thing Senator Farrelly has gotten here when he did, because this bill is, we're finding all kinds of problems with it, Senator. Some of the issues we're finding is that when a person is convicted on line 13 of those violations, it doesn't have to be in relationship with any of the issues of hunting, trapping, angling, which that language is taken out on line 24. So now we could have hundreds of these violations coming to the Fish and Wildlife Commission for relocation. And then the same way with the boat issue.
Can I confirm?
Yes, uh-huh. So you better come and rescue this thing because it's about to sink to the bottom of the river.
Mr. Chairman, there are never any problems. There are only opportunities.
Okay. Good thing you're here.
Mr. Chairman, let me give a couple of answers to the concerns that you've shared with me today. First of all,
Representative Barr.
Let me identify myself for the record. My name is Ted Farrelly, and I am a state senator from District 28. The reason this bill was brought forward has much to do with the issue of malicious intent on behalf of the folks that are trespassing on private property. And they do so for a variety of reasons. They go up on the property to collect horn hunters, and they're paid $8 to $12 a pound for these things, and sometimes more. And then there's mushrooms. And then there's just a whole variety of special forest products and different commodities that happen to exist in rural areas. And often these are more remote areas with less law enforcement presence, but still the landowner is the person that has to pay for the rutted fields and the cut fences and the vandalism from random gunfire and some other things that happen out on more.
We understand that, Senate. We have to be. We only have 10 more minutes here.
The issue, sir, Mr. Chairman, is that the violations under OS 166.630 are for criminal trespass, and criminal trespass is a higher standard of proof, and it has to show malicious intent that you knew what you were doing, you were there to commit a crime, you didn't have permission of the landowner, and you're going on the property with the intent of doing something that was illegal. So that one of the issues is, I don't think there's any circumstance which a prosecutor would look at somebody's inadvertent landing a boat, for instance, and having a malicious intent to do something knowingly illegal. It just isn't going to happen.
Do we have cases of criminal trespass in other areas besides out on along riverbanks? Where else in the state could there be people persecuted or convicted of criminal trespass in the cities?
Yes, sir. Yeah, that would be if in a case of a burglary attempt.
Well, I guess that was our problem. See, it opens it up to that statute of criminal trespass that could happen in cities everywhere, and they would all fall in under this statute of revoking their hunting and fishing license if they had one, and probably wouldn't even be involved and taking their boat certificate, and these people wouldn't have a boat. And the court said must notify. Paul had a problem. The court shall send a copy to the Marine Board. Well, they'd get a copy then of every criminal trespass that happens in the state, and they'd have to go through their records then to figure out whether that people had a boat. So it seemed like that was the problem we were having. It opened it all up. These three statutes opened it up to every case, every conviction out here across the state that might not even be involved with the issues that we're kind of looking at here.
Representative Wells, I agree that the net is cast rather broadly here. Let me try to deal with another issue before we come back to that. The issue of the navigability question. Navigability is becoming my favorite topic in the world. I've spent 2 years working with navigability, worked with it in the last legislature.
We didn't really want to get into that. I was trying to keep Mr. Beaver away from that because we needed a few more months to solve that issue. We're trying to deal with this with these statutes here that are in this bill is where we're having the problem.
The offering that I can make to the committee to make it to ease its concerns about the navigability issue is I would regard as a friendly amendment the removal of the question of revocation of Marine Board licenses, if that were something that this organization thought was reasonable and necessary. It wasn't our intent to get into the issue of navigability. What our intent was to do in regard to criminal trespass on these rural lands was to make sure that folks that value their recreational opportunities almost above every other thing understood that they had something at risk beyond a $50 citation. So if the revocation of a boat license is one of the issues that stands between us moving the bill,
I think we have a little problem even on the front there. It's pretty wide. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I guess my problem with the bill is you delete the language in 23 through 26, which talks about these violations while the person was angling, hunting, trapping. I guess if for this bill to move forward, I would be comfortable if there are certain things such as horn collecting, as you wanted to also tie to, then I can understand. But this is such a broad opening of that window that I don't think I can go there. I understand your intent, but you know this is for everything under the sun that falls underneath these. I mean, for God's sake, someone throws a rock at a train and they can't hunt anymore. I can't go there.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a question. This has to do with your schedule for the committee.
We can hold this bill. We don't need to do anything with it today. We can hold it and bring it back another time.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask if I could work with Representative Beyer and other members of the committee to try and focus the bill on the issues that we originally aimed the bill at, and that was to reduce the incidences of malicious and trespass issues on rural lands where there's damage to land.
I think what we need to do, we'll close the hearing, and we won't kill the bill or anything. Close the hearing, and I'll give everybody a chance to work on it between now and whenever we get something worked out, we can bring it back.
Mr. Chairman, I think that is a wonderful opportunity that you've brought to this meeting today.
Well, close the hearing on 7670. Nice to have everyone here, and we'll see you next Tuesday.